This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by a brilliant founder and leader and investor. We're joined today by Sarah Choi. Sarah is a graduate of Harvard Business School, Harvard undergraduate. She's the founder of several ventures. She's now with Wing Venture Capital. She's been there for several years and is a partner there. Sarah, can you take a moment, tell us a little bit about yourself and about Wing Venture Capital, and then we'll go from there.
Happy to. Thanks for having me, Scott. So like you mentioned, I also was a founder back in my day. Sometimes I call myself a recovering founder. I had, in fact, led product for one startup, which did not have venture backing. Ultimately, unfortunately, it did not work out, despite getting to double digits millions in success at one point. The next venture I co-founded, that one we had three venture capitalists in early. They were the first investors, in fact. And then ended up growing the company. Eventually it sold, but two very different experiences, which led me to quote unquote this side of the table, where now, as you noted, I'm a partner at Wing VC. And Wing itself is an early stage enterprise focused venture capital firm, meaning I invest in anything from pre-seed all the way through A. And particularly, I oversee our investments at the intersection of biology and data. Sometimes you can think of it as health slash data, again, at the early stage.
When you think about the differences in success in the two different ventures that you were a founder of, give us a sense of what advice would you have for founders? What worked? What didn't work? Why did one succeed magnificently? Why did one not get there? Talk a little bit about how you view that and what are things you look for to be successful?
Sure, happy to. You know, I think there's a pretty stark difference in the two companies where in one situation, it was really just me and my future co-founder, who was my business partner at the time, just us two leading this company, again, without the venture investors, without advisors, just trying to figure things out on our own. And inevitably, you know, we figured some things out, but just because it's a way to do things doesn't mean it's the right way. And my gosh, it sure would have been nice to have some supportive voices helping us see around corners, helping us make better decisions during that extremely lonely time. And as I mentioned, we failed. And then the next time around, we had the benefit of community, where it was not just our venture investors. We also had over 30 angels. We had an advisory board. We had plenty of advice around the table. Of course, not all of it perfect advice, but enough where we could weigh the different opinions and choose what worked for us. And thankfully, that one did better. So my advice to founders is always, okay, before you even start, can you do some of the pre-work of deciding, hey, is this life even right for me? It's one of the hardest, and I would also say loneliest jobs in the world, where sometimes I was having the highest highs of my life and the lowest lows, sometimes in the same day. So I always caution founders, be careful that you know exactly what you're signing up for, because it is a hard and long journey. And then after that, I think it's critical that you find the right support around the table, and not just professionally, by the way, although that's extremely important as well. I also mean on a personal level, where I personally have now a group of people who I go to for advice, I go to with my hardest, thorniest problems. And those people are not just specific to my business or any one point in time in life for me, but really I carry those people throughout my entire life. And I think of them really more like personal advisors.
Fascinating. And this concept of, you know, there's this old concept of you can go fast by yourself, but much further with the team. How much does that thought or that adage resonate with you as you look at these two different experiences as a founder?
Yeah, I think that resonates a lot with me. You just can't build huge, successful organizations without a lot of people being involved. And so as much as some founders think, hey, I want to do this because I want to own my own destiny, I want to be the sole person making decisions and have to only report to myself, you know, that's just false. You really need a team of people who are inspired and motivated by what you're doing in order to help the organization succeed and all boats rise. So I 100% subscribe to that. And look, you know, I am the VC. I'm not saying everyone needs to get VCs. I'm just saying simply, look,
but if you
it's
going to
be a lot more fun. You know, you need serious people with you. And I do think there's an advantage of venture funding in that it can help you accelerate whatever product market fit you might have in a way that would just take a really long time if ever you were to get there by doing it on your own. Plus that added dimension, like you mentioned, Scott, of who would have the capability to self-fund and create a company. Well, that would probably limit the number of founders to those who are ultra wealthy. And I don't think that the best ideas are just kept in that group of people. I believe that good ideas can come from anywhere and anyone. Therefore, that is one of the advantages of venture capital money.
Well, and you talk about the ultra wealthy. You take a person that has $100 million, $500 million, whatever the number is you consider ultra wealthy, and that person is unlikely to want to grind it out and grit it out to really be a founder again. Maybe to be a founder and build a team, but it's very different just funding something versus really being integrally involved in it and having the leadership and capacity in building a team to do it. They're very different things, aren't they?
You know, I do think that, being the venture investor versus being the founder, they are very different things. And my job is not to have the best ideas or to be the sole person with the innovation. I rely on my CEOs, quite frankly, for that. But I do think that there are some people who have tried once, maybe gone to a certain degree of success, and then want to try a second startup, and more kudos to them. You learn so much on the first ride, and maybe you have a big success on the first time. But the second time founder also brings so much wisdom, you know, regardless of if they were successful or not in the first endeavor. So I definitely make sure to pay attention to people who have a few bumps and scrapes from their entrepreneurial journeys, because if they're coming back the second time, I know that they really mean it and they really want to do a good job the second time around.
Certainly. I've got so many questions I want to ask you. Tell us a little bit about your experience at Harvard. You're there for undergraduate and business school. What was that like? Were they very different experiences, undergraduate and business school?
Yeah, they were. You know, as an undergrad, I came in and, you know, my dad was a mailman. My mom was a teacher. So I didn't have exposure to a lot of the jobs that I was encountering as being options for myself. I ended up dropping out. You know, I went back eventually and I finished, but I took a leave trying to figure out what I wanted to do. It was during that time that I decided that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. But certainly that first time around was a confusing time and definitely a period where I just wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, nor quite frankly, who I was. The second time that I came back around though for business school, at that point, I had spent 4 years at Google, had these company experiences under my belt, including starting my own company. So it was a very different experience being 30 versus being in my late teens, that's for sure.
But it's a fascinating experience and it's so relatable to so many people. I mean, so many people don't really figure themselves out or figure what they want to do in business or professionally until sometime in their mid to late 20s, you know, or if they're fortunate. They really figured out at that point. And the differences in success and the differences in satisfaction once somebody has sort of figured it out are exponentially different. I mean, once you figure out your own goals, what you want to do, your chance of success, your chance of enjoying it are so different when you're just on a track that somebody's put somebody on.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. Even when you are younger, I always encourage young people to do exactly what you said, which is to forge your own path, to not let someone arbitrarily put you on a path, because the reality is we all have options. Even people who think that they don't oftentimes have many, many, many options, and we can choose where we want to work, what we put our time towards, how we want our lives to be. So for me as an undergrad, I wasn't sure that college was right at that time for me. So I took a bit of time off, came back, was a much better student, by the way, and was more directed and just personally fulfilled. And that was an option for me. But then throughout my 20s, I certainly did not just go down the corporate path because I knew that I wanted to forge the kind of life that I would feel motivated by, that I would feel impassioned by, where every day going to work didn't feel like work, but felt like something that I would wake up and feel really proud of doing. And so that led me to entrepreneurship. Eventually, that's led me to Wing, where I wake up every day so excited to A, meet the most incredible people I've ever met in my life, truly. And then B, also start to give back. And personally, I'm super invigorated by the idea of, hey, democratizing some of this information that I've learned, sometimes the hard way, and making it so that this information does not reside in privileged walled gardens, does not just reside in the heads of the ultra wealthy who have the capacities to back companies or start companies because of their personal net worth. Like I said before, I believe that good ideas can come from anywhere. Therefore, it is my joy in this role as a venture capitalist to listen to new ideas, to back founders, to support entrepreneurs and innovators in their world-changing ideas, just something that gives me a tremendous amount of joy. And I don't know if I would have been able to make this had I not been encouraged at various points on my journey to take a step off of that quote-unquote traditional path, being forced on someone else's timelines to have my nose to the grind.
And Cyril, let me ask you this question. You know, your parents, a teacher and a mailman, or you know, postal worker. The when you dropped out of Harvard, how concerned were they? Were they supportive? Were they concerned? Were they like, oh my goodness, what's going on with our child prodigy? How did they view that? How did they manage that?
So when I took my leave of absence, my parents were 100% supportive. But I do think that's because my parents were immigrants, and their parents actually were immigrants to the original country my parents were born in. So I had two generations of immigrants. And through that experience, where my parents grew up in abject poverty, they taught me from a very young age where there's a will, there's a way. And some of these things we're discussing about forging your own path came really from them at its origination. So I credit them with a lot of my mentality. And they were the kind of parents who said, hey, Sarah, you know, you're getting really good grades in high school. Are you sure that's not giving you a big head? Maybe you should learn some humility and get some worse grades. I think that'd be a good lesson to just give you a snapshot into their minds and their philosophy. So I think, yeah, when I decided to bring this up, they were surprised, certainly, but they supported me at the end of the day. And I'll add, they also supported me. When I became a founder, even though I caught my mom at various points in time telling her girlfriends, oh, Sarah, yeah, she's unemployed, but I'm sure she'll figure it out, because she just didn't know what I was doing as a founder. She actually thought I was unemployed for some period of time.
I mean, just absolutely fascinating. One of the children is on it, totally is a, you know, magnificent student. They're both magnificent students, but one is a young associate at a Big Four accounting firm. One wants to just be an entrepreneur, and he's still going to get through school to get to that spot. But as a parent, there is some fright and there's some comfort in the daughter that's at the Big Four accounting firm, consulting firm, as a young consultant. The son who says, I just want to be an entrepreneur. You're like, well, it'd be good to work for a few years first. I mean, it's a very, very fascinating situation as a parent, and just to watch. And I could just imagine your parents' thoughts and the multiple different thoughts of, we have a daughter that got into Harvard, first generation immigrants. I was a second generation immigrant family. My grandparents are immigrants. And when I didn't get an A in school, the parents were unhappy. They were very serious about it. And it was a very interesting experience. It's just like not that far from being an immigrant and the parental mentality of it and so forth. Just fascinating. Fascinating.
I get that. I get that. Totally. I mean, it's a huge leap of faith, I think, for them to have told me that, because I bet you anything, actually what they were thinking was, oh my goodness, what? But they put a shield on it, and they just at least verbally supported me. So I'm grateful for that. But I 100% get where you're coming from.
And rightfully so, and fantastic. And talk about for a second, What are you most focused on and excited about this year, Sarah? Where are you focused? And then I do want to ask you about the Harvard Founders Network and what that is as well, that you helped
found. Sure, happy to.
But yeah, talk about what you're most excited about this year. Maybe tell us a little bit about that too.
Yeah, so I am super excited and bullish on this area of what I call BioX data, biology meets data. And I'm excited for a number of reasons. I mean, I've studied biology back in school, and so it's something that was a personal passion of mine. But I think there's actually a very commanding why right now is a exceptional time in BioX data, perhaps historic time, because finally we have the tools, for example, machine learning, in order to make sense of the crazy proliferation of data that's happening, that's enabled by these data collection engines, for example, genomic sequencing, that just weren't possible before. So because of these tools, we not only have higher throughput, we also have a greater data proliferation than we've ever seen before. And that gives me hope. That gives me hope because biology is extraordinarily complicated and we need sophisticated tools. For example, AI, machine learning, in order to understand biology and then derive insight that ultimately will lead to us leading measurably better quality lives, higher quality lives, as well as living longer. Because in fact, the predictions are that these technologies that are being worked on literally right now, they're being forged in labs right now all across the world. These are going to help us live maybe 2-3 decades longer, which is an extraordinary thing in my estimation. And was the same thing, by the way, that happened in the past during the time when vaccines were developed, which enabled us to now have chronic disease as our number one killers, as opposed to things that viruses have now been able to save us from. So who can imagine what's going to happen in the next couple decades? I think it looks extraordinarily promising and obviously gives me a lot of energy.
I mean, just absolutely fascinating. Truly, the acceleration of the ability to solve problems, even to look at COVID vaccines as a perfect example, a generation ago, we couldn't have come out with a vaccine probably within a year. And now just with the kinds of things you're talking about, so much of an ability to do so. Take a moment, Sarah, and tell us about the Harvard Founders Network and what that is that you co-founded.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I founded the Harvard Founder Network back when I was a founder. And it just started with me, a couple friends who were also founders, getting together over dinners and really just being open, honest, and real with one another. And so that is the place where the community began. That is a place where the community is now. And so it's a school-oriented thing, but you don't have to currently be in school to be a member. In fact, a lot of our members are professors or have graduated many, many years ago from all the different schools over at Harvard. And really, it's just a community of support at the end of the day. And that's something I encourage. You know, mine happened to be around a school affiliation, but it doesn't have to be that way. It could be around a city, a theme, an age demographic, what have you. I've seen all sorts of flavors for things like this, but I do think it's very important because odds are if you're facing something, you're not alone. And other people have faced that in the past or maybe are facing it today. And the sort of tribal knowledge that comes out when you have a bunch of smart people around the table and you're being open and honest, real and vulnerable with them, sharing in a very honest way what's going on, it's just extraordinary. So that's something I've had the privilege of starting, and now I still lead the organization. But again, does not have to just be a Harvard organization. I encourage people to go out there and start organizations similarly for whatever it is that you think would be a good convening force.
So fascinating. And you're an absolute pleasure to visit with because you talk about things that went well, things that didn't go well, and it makes you so much more relatable to the audience, myself, to everybody. When you get into a group of Harvard graduates and people are talking about different things, how much do you have to fight through the one person that wants to say, well, my business is bigger than your business. My business is this. I've done this. I've succeeded at that. How much do you have to fight through that kind of ego stuff, or people leave some of that ego at the door?
You know, people leave the ego at the door. We've never had conversations of that flavor because it was started with the intention of being open, honest, real, helpful. And in order to be helpful, you need to know what's really going on. So we start every meeting by going around the table and sharing not just a high, but also a low. And you'd be surprised. Someone you think is on top of the world, having just raised multiple millions of dollars, their company is surely IPO bound, could be struggling with something under your very nose. And unless asked, they probably would never share. So we make sure to leave a space so people can share, bring their real selves to these meetings. Therefore, there is much less chest thumping and ego and bravado as opposed to real sort of authentic, genuine person-to-person sharing.
I mean, you do see one of the things I find fascinating is people that have been venture capital funded at a nice size level, thinking right now of a company that's funded with a $50 million valuation, lots of money, $40, $50 million put into the company. And suddenly the founder's face is, oh my goodness, we have to hire a ton of people on the commercial side, a ton of people that are in the engineering side, and not really, and just like, you know, almost so excited that the dog that caught the car and now has to actually put that money to work in building a sales team, building a commercialization team, building a stronger engineering team. That's a little scary, isn't it?
It is, for sure. And you think it gets better at the next stage? It doesn't. And that's a thing that people need to evaluate before they even get into entrepreneurship. It seems like your problems will be solved with the next milestone, whether that's funding, whether that's certain revenue milestone. Guess again. Every time you get to those milestones, there'll be another set of challenges, and they'll look thornier and more complicated and be harder to figure out. And that means you're doing well if your problems are getting harder and harder down the road, and that continues. And you think going IPO means all your problems will be solved? Guess again. And
right, a whole
really
different set of problems.
Why.
Now you got to deal with people shorting your stock, all kinds of other problems, and so forth, all kinds of regulatory issues, and so forth. And it is a fascinating issue about success. If you haven't really touched success, and somebody punches you in the nose, and there's a lot of truth to that. Until you've had some negative hitbacks or pushbacks, you really haven't gotten to a spot where you're worthy of having those things. It's really a fascinating adage also on success and getting hit in the nose and so forth. But the problems don't get easier; they get more complex as you've got bigger revenue targets, bigger profit targets, bigger staffing challenges, all those kinds of things, don't they?
Exactly. Yep, I 100% agree with that, Scott.
Sarah, what a great pleasure to visit with you. Thank you for taking the time to join us today on the Becker Private Equity Podcast. What a pleasure, and congratulations on your success. And what a remarkable story. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure was mine.